between the living room and the kitchen. It looked very improbable there, like seeing a rubber boot on a church altar or a rose lying on the engine block of a tractor. One of the rubber bands holding the note to the rocket snapped, but the other was still okay. Brian's gaze shifted to the left, and he found himself regarding the Jurzik Sony TV. Brian wound up and threw. The rock hit the Sony dead on. There was a hollow bang, a flash of light, and glass showered all over the carpet. The TV tottered on its stand, but did not quite fall over.
"Strike two,"
Brian muttered, then gave voice to a strange, strangled laugh. He threw the other rock at a bunch of ceramic knick-knacks standing on a table by the sofa, but missed. It hit the wall with a thump and gouged out a chunk of plaster. Brian laid hold of the playmate's handle and lugged it around to the side of the house. He broke two bedroom windows. In back, he pegged a loaf-sized rock through the window in the top half of the kitchen door, then threw several more through the hole. One of these shattered the Cuisinart standing on the counter. Another blasted through the glass front of the radar range and landed right inside the microwave.
"Strike three! Sit down, Bush!"
Brian cried, and then laughed so hard he almost wet his pants. When the throw had passed, he finished his circuit of the house. The playmate was lighter now. He found he could carry it with one hand. He used his last three rocks to break the basement windows which showed among Wilma's fall flowers, then ripped up a few handfuls of the blooms for good measure. With that done, he closed the cooler, returned to his bicycle, put the playmate into the basket, and mounted up for the ride home. The Miss Leberskys lived next door to the Jurziks. As Brian pedaled out of the Jurzik driveway, Mrs. Leberski opened her front door and came out on the stoop. She was dressed in a bright green wrapper. Her hair was bound up in a red do-rag. She looked like an advertisement for Christmas in Hell.
"What's going on over there, boy?" she asked sharply.
"I don't know exactly. I think Mr. and Mrs. Jurzik must be having an argument," Brian said, not stopping. "I just came over to ask if they needed anyone to shovel their driveway this winter, but I decided to come back another time."
Mrs. Leberski directed a brief, baleful glance at the Jurzik house. Because of the hedges, only the second story was visible from where she stood. "If I were you, I wouldn't come back at all," she said. "That woman reminds me of those little fish they have down in South America, the ones that eat the cows whole."
"Piranha fish," Brian said.
"That's right, those."
Brian kept on pedaling. He was now drawing away from the woman in the green wrapper and the red do-rag. His heart was hustling right along, but it wasn't hammering or racing or anything like that. Part of him felt quite sure he was still dreaming. He didn't feel like himself at all, not like the Brian Rusk who got all A's and B's, the Brian Rusk who was a member of the Student Council in the Middle School Good Citizens League, the Brian Rusk who got nothing but ones in deportment.
"She'll kill somebody one of these days," Mrs. Leberski called indignantly after Brian. "You just mark my words."
Under his breath, Brian whispered,
"I wouldn't be a bit surprised."
He did indeed spend the rest of the day in bed. Under ordinary circumstances, this would have concerned Cora, perhaps enough to take Brian over to the dock in the box in Norway. Today, however, she hardly noticed that her son wasn't feeling well. This was because of the wonderful sunglasses Mr. Gaunt had sold her. She was absolutely entranced with them. Brian got up around 6 o'clock, about 15 minutes before his pa came in from a day spent fishing on the lake with two friends. He got himself a Pepsi from the fridge and stood by the stove, drinking it. He felt quite a bit better. He felt as if he might have finally fulfilled his part of the deal he had made with Mr. Gaunt. He had also decided that Mr. Gaunt did indeed know best. Nettie Cobb, without the slightest premonition of the unpleasant surprise awaiting her at home, was in high good spirits as she walked down Main Street toward needful things. She had a strong intuition that, Sunday morning or not, the shop would be open, and she was not disappointed.
"Mrs. Cobb," Leland Gaunt said as she came in, "how very nice to see you."
"It's nice to see you too, Mr. Gaunt," she said, and it was.
Mr. Gaunt came over, his hand out, but Nettie shrank away from his touch. It was dreadful behavior, so impolite, but she simply couldn't help herself. And Mr. Gaunt seemed to understand, God bless him. He smiled and changed course, closing the door behind her instead. He flipped the sign from open to closed with the speed of a professional gambler palming an ace.
"Sit down, Mrs. Cobb. Please, sit down."
"Well, all right. But I just came to tell you that Polly is..." She felt strange somehow. Not bad exactly, but strange. Swimmy in the head. She sat down rather gracelessly in one of the plush chairs. Then Mr. Gaunt was standing before her, his eyes fixed on hers, and the world seemed to center upon him and grow still again. "Polly isn't feeling so well, is she?" Mr. Gaunt asked. "That's it," Nettie said gratefully. "It's a hands, you know. She has arthritis. Yes, terrible. Such a shame. Shit happens. Life's a bitch, and then you die. Tough titty," said the kitty. "I know, Nettie." Mr. Gaunt's eyes were growing again. "But there's no need for me to call her, or call on her, for that matter. Her hands are feeling much better now."
"Are they?" Nettie said distantly.
"You betcha. They still hurt, of course, which is good, but they don't hurt badly enough to keep her away, and that's better still. Don't you agree, Nettie?"
"Yes,"
Nettie said faintly, but she had no idea of what she was agreeing to.
"You," Mr. Gaunt said in his softest, most cheerful voice, "have got a big day ahead of you, Nettie."
"I do?" It was news to her. She had been planning to spend the afternoon in her favorite living room chair, knitting and watching TV with Raider at her feet.
"Yes, a very big day. So I want you to sit there and rest for a moment while I go get something. Will you do that?"
"Yes."
"Good. And close your eyes, why don't you? Have a really good rest, Nettie."
Nettie obediently closed her eyes. An unknown length of time later, Mr. Gaunt told her to open them again. She did, and felt a pang of disappointment. When people told you to close your eyes, sometimes they wanted to give you something nice. A present. She had hoped that, when she opened her eyes again, Mr. Gaunt might be holding another carnival glass lampshade, but all he had was a pad of paper. The sheets were small and pink. Each one was headed with the words, "Traffic Violation Warning."
"Oh," she said. "I thought it might be carnival glass."
"I don't think you'll be needing any more carnival glass, Nettie."
"No."
The pang of disappointment returned. It was stronger this time.
"No. Sad but true. Still, I imagine you remember promising you'd do something for me."
Mr. Gaunt sat down next to her. "You do remember that, don't you?"
"Yes," she said. "You want me to play a trick on Buster. You want me to put some papers in his house."
"That's right, Nettie. Very good. Do you still have the key I gave you?" Slowly, like a woman in an underwater ballet, Nettie brought the key from the right-hand pocket of her coat. She held it up so Mr. Gaunt could see it.
"That's very good," he told her warmly. "Now put it back, Nettie. Put it back where it's safe."
She did. "Now, here are the papers." He put the pink pad in one of her hands. Into the other, he placed a scotch tape dispenser. Alarm bells were going off somewhere inside her now, but they were far away, hardly audible.
"I hope this won't take long. I ought to go home soon. I have to feed Raider. He's my little dog."
"I know all about Raider," said Mr. Gaunt, and offered Nettie a wide smile. "But I have a feeling that he doesn't have much appetite today."
"I don't think you need to worry about him pooping on the kitchen floor, either."
"But..." He touched her lips with one of his long fingers, and she felt suddenly sick to her stomach.
"Don't," she whined, pressing back into her chair. "Don't. It's awful."
"So they tell me," Mr. Gaunt agreed. "So if you don't want me to be awful to you, Nettie, you mustn't ever say that awful little word to me."
"What word?"
"But. I disapprove of that word. In fact, I think it's fair to say I hate that word. In the best of all possible worlds, there would be no need for such a puling little word. I want you to say something else for me, Nettie. I want you to say some words that I love, words that I absolutely adore."
"What words?"
"Mr. Gaunt knows best." "Say that." "Mr. Gaunt knows best," she repeated, and as soon as the words were out of her mouth, she understood how absolutely and completely true they were. "Mr. Gaunt always knows best."
"Mr. Gaunt always knows best."
"Right, just like Father," Mr. Gaunt said, and then laughed hideously. It was a sound like plates of rock moving deep in the earth, and the color of his eyes shifted rapidly from blue to green to brown to black when he did it. "Now, Nettie, listen carefully. You have this one little errand to do for me, and then you can go home. Do you understand?" Nettie understood, and she listened very carefully. South Paris is a small and squalid mill town 18 miles northeast of Castle Rock. It is not the only jerkwater main town named after a European city or country. There is a Madrid, the natives pronounce it Madrid, a Sweden, an Etna, a Calais, pronounced so it rhymes with Dallas, a Cambridge, and a Frankfurt. Someone may know how or why so many wide places in the road ended up with such an exotic variety of names, but I do not. What I do know is that about 20 years ago, a very good French chef decided to move out of New York and open his own restaurant in Maine's Lakes region, and that he further decided there could be no better place for such a venture than a town named South Paris. Not even the stench of the tanning mills could dissuade him. The result was an eating establishment called Maurice. It is still there to this day on Route 117 by the railroad tracks and just across the road from McDonald's. And it was to Maurice that Danforth Buster Keaton took his wife for lunch on Sunday, October 13th. Myrtle spent a good deal of that Sunday in an ecstatic daze, and the fine food at Maurice was not the reason. For the last few months, almost a year, really, life with Danforth had been extremely unpleasant. He ignored her almost completely, except when he yelled at her. Her self-esteem, which had never been very high, plummeted to new depths. She knew as well as any woman ever has that abuse does not have to be administered with the fists to be effective. Men as well as women can wound with their tongues, and Danforth Keaton knew how to use his very well. He had inflicted 1,000 invisible cuts on her with its sharp sides over the last year. She did not know about the gambling. She really believed he went to the track mostly to watch. She didn't know about the embezzlement either. She did know that several members of Danforth's family had been unstable, but she did not connect this behavior with Danforth himself. He didn't drink to excess, didn't forget to put on his clothes before going out in the morning, didn't talk to people who weren't there, and so she assumed he was all right. She assumed, in other words, that something was wrong with her, that at some point this something had simply caused Danforth to stop loving her. She had spent the last 6 months or so trying to face the bleak prospect of the 30 or even 40 loveless years which lay ahead of her as this man's mate, this man who had become by turns angry, coldly sarcastic, and unmindful of her. She had become just another piece of furniture as far as Danforth was concerned, unless, of course, she got in his way. If she did that, if his supper wasn't ready for him when he was ready for it, if the floor in his study looked dirty to him, even if the sections of the newspaper were in the wrong order when he came to the breakfast table, he called her dumb. He told her that if her ass fell off, she wouldn't know where to find it. He said that if brains were black powder, she wouldn't be able to blow her nose without a blasting cap. At first she had tried to defend herself from these tirades, but he cut her defenses apart as if they were the walls of a child's cardboard castle. If she grew angry in turn, he overtopped her into white rages that terrified her. So she had given anger up and had descended into dooms of bewilderment instead. These days she only smiled helplessly in the face of his anger, promised to do better, and went to their room, where she lay on the bed and wept, and wondered whatever was to become of her, and wished that she had a friend she could talk to. She talked to her dolls instead. She'd started collecting them during the first few years of her marriage, and had always kept them in boxes in the attic. During the last year, though, she had brought them down to the sewing room, and sometimes, after her tears were shed, she crept into the sewing room and played with them. They never shouted. They never ignored. They never asked her how she got so stupid. Did it come naturally, or did she take lessons? She had found the most wonderful doll of all yesterday in the new shop. And today, everything had changed. This morning, to be exact. Her hand crept under the table, and she pinched herself, not for the first time, just to make sure she wasn't dreaming. But after the pinch, she was still here in Maurice, sitting in a bar of bright October sunshine, and Danforth was still there, across the table from her, eating with hearty good appetite, his face wreathed in a smile that looked almost alien to her, because she hadn't seen one there in such a long time. She didn't know what had caused the change and was afraid to ask. She knew he had gone off to Lewiston Raceway last night, just as he almost always did during the evening, presumably because the people he met there were more interesting than the people he met every day in Castle Rock, his wife, for instance. And when she woke up this morning, she expected to find his half of the bed empty, or not slept in at all, which would mean that he had spent the rest of the night dozing in his study chair, and to hear him downstairs, muttering to himself in his bad-tempered way. Instead, he had been in bed beside her, wearing the striped red pajamas she had given him for Christmas last year. This was the first time she had ever seen him wear them, the first time they'd ever been out of the box, as far as she knew. He was awake. He rolled over on his side to face her, already smiling. At first, the smile had frightened her. She thought it might mean he was getting ready to kill her. Then he touched her breast and winked. Want too much, or is it too early in the day for you? So they had made love. For the first time in over 5 months, they had made love, and he had been absolutely magnificent. And now, here they were, lunching at Maurice on an early Sunday afternoon like a pair of young lovers. She didn't know what had happened to work this wondrous change in her husband, and didn't care. She only wanted to enjoy it, and to hope it wouldn't last. Everything okay, Mert? Keaton asked, looking up from his plate and scrubbing vigorously at his face with his napkin. She reached shyly across the table and touched his hand. Everything's fine. Everything is just wonderful. She had to take her hand away so she could dab hastily at her eyes with her napkin. Keaton went on chowing into his bouffe bourguignon, or whatever it was the froggies called it, with great appetite. The reason for his happiness was simple. Every horse he had picked yesterday afternoon with the help of winning ticket had come in for him last night. Even Malabar, the 30-to-1 shot in the 10th race. He had come back to Castle Rock not so much driving as floating on air with better than $18,000 stuffed into his overcoat pockets. His bookie was probably still wondering where the money went. Keaton knew. It was safely tucked away in the back of his study closet. It was in an envelope. The envelope was in the winning ticket box, along with the precious game itself. He had slept well for the first time in months, and when he woke up, he had a glimmering of an idea about the audit. A glimmering wasn't much, of course, but it was better than the confused darkness that had been roaring through his head since that awful letter came. All he had needed to get his brain out of neutral, it seemed, was one winning night at the track. He could not make total restitution before the axe fell, that much was clear. Lewiston Raceway was the only track which ran nightly during the fall season, for one thing, and it was pretty small potatoes. He could tour the local county fairs and make a few thousand at the races there, but that wouldn't be enough either. Nor could he risk many nights like last night, even at the raceway. His bookie would grow wary, then refuse to accept his bets at all. But he believed he could make partial restitution and minimize the size of the fiddles at the same time. He could also spin a tale, a surefire development prospect that hadn't come off, a terrible mistake, but one for which he had taken complete responsibility and for which he was now making good. He could point out that a really unscrupulous man, if placed in such a position as this, might well have used the grace period to scoop even more money out of the town treasury, as much as he possibly could, and then to run for a place, some sunny place with lots of palm trees and lots of white beaches and lots of young girls in string bikinis, from which extradition was difficult or downright impossible. he could wax Christ-like and invite those among them without sin to cast the first stone. That should give them pause. If there was a man Jack among them who had not had his fingers in the state pie from time to time, Keaton would eat that man's shorts without salt. They would have to give him time. Now that he was able to set his hysteria aside and think the situation over rationally, he was almost sure they would. After all, they were politicians too. They would know that the press would have plenty of tar and feathers left over for them, the supposed guardians of the public trust, once they had finished with Dan Keaton. They would know the questions which would surface in the wake of a public investigation or even, God forbid, a trial for embezzlement. Questions like, how long, in fiscal years, if you please, gentlemen, had Mr. Keaton's little operation been going on? Questions like how come the State Bureau of Taxation hadn't awakened and smelled the coffee some time ago? Questions ambitious men would find distressing. He believed he could squeak through. No guarantees, but it looked possible. All thanks to Mr. Leland Gaunt. God, he loved Leland Gaunt. Danforth? Mert asked shyly. He looked up. This is the nicest day I've had in years. I just wanted you to know that. How grateful I am to have such a nice day. With you. Oh, he said. The oddest thing had just happened to him. For a moment, he hadn't been able to remember the name of the woman sitting across from him. Well, Mert, it's been nice for me, too. Will you be going to the racetrack tonight? No, he said. I think tonight I'll stay home. That's nice, she said. She found it so nice, in fact, that she had to dab at her eyes with her napkin again. He smiled at her. It wasn't his old, sweet smile, the one which had wooed and won her to begin with, but it was close. Say, Mert, want dessert? She giggled and flapped her napkin at him. Oh, you! The Keaton home was a split-level ranch in Castle View. It was a long walk uphill for Nettie Cobb, and by the time she got there, her legs were tired and she was very cold. She met only three or four other pedestrians, and none of them looked at her. They were bundled deep into the collars of their coats, for the wind had begun to blow strongly, and it had a keen edge. An ad supplement from someone's Sunday Telegram blew across the street, then took off into the hard blue sky like some strange bird as she turned into the Keaton's driveway. Mr. Gaunt had told her that Buster and Myrtle wouldn't be home, and Mr. Gaunt knew best. The garage door was up, and that showboat of a Cadillac Buster drove was gone. Nettie went up the walk, stopped at the front door, and took the pad and the scotch tape from her left-hand coat pocket. She very much wanted to be home with the Sunday supermovie on TV and Raider at her feet, and that's where she would be as soon as she finished this chore. She might not even bother with her knitting. She might just sit there with her carnival glass lampshade in her lap. She tore off the first pink slip and taped it over the sign by the doorbell, the embossed one which said, "The Keatons," and "No salesman, please." She put the tape and the pad back into her left pocket, then took the key from her right and slipped it into the lock. Before turning it, she briefly examined the pink slip she had just taped up. Cold and tired as she was, she just had to smile a little. It really was a pretty good joke, especially considering the way Buster drove. It was a wonder he hadn't killed anyone. She wouldn't like to be the man whose name was signed at the bottom of the warning slip, though. Buster could be awfully grouchy. Even as a child, he hadn't been one to take a joke. She turned the key. The lock opened easily. Nettie went inside. "More coffee?" Keaton asked. "Not for me," Myrtle said. "I'm full as a tick." She smiled. "Then let's go home. I want to watch the Patriots on TV. He glanced at his watch. "If we hurry, I think I can make the kickoff." Myrtle nodded, happier than ever. The TV was in the living room, and if Dan meant to watch the game, he wasn't going to spend the afternoon cooped up in his study. "Let's hurry, then," she said. Keaton held up one commanding finger. "Waitress, bring me the check, please." Nettie had stopped wanting to hurry home. She liked being in Buster and Myrtle's house. For one thing, it was warm. For another, being here gave Nettie an unexpected sense of power. It was like seeing behind the scenes of two actual human lives. She began by going upstairs and looking through all the rooms. There were a lot of them, too, considering there were no children, but, as her mother had always been fond of saying, them as has gets. She opened Myrtle's bureau drawers, investigating her underwear. Some of it was silk, quality stuff, but to Nettie, most of the good things looked old. The same was true of the dresses hung on her side of the closet. Nettie went on to the bathroom, where she inventoried the pills in the medicine cabinet, and from there to the sewing room, where she admired the dolls. A nice house. A lovely house. Too bad the man who lived here was a piece of shit. Nettie glanced at her watch and supposed she should start putting up the little pink slips, and she would, too, just as soon as she finished looking around downstairs.
"Danforth, isn't this a little too fast?" Myrtle asked breathlessly as they swung around a slow-moving pulp truck.
An oncoming car blared its horn at them as Keaton swung back into his lane. "I want to make the kickoff," he said, and turned left onto the Maple Sugar Road, passing a sign which read, "Castle Rock, 8 miles." Nettie snapped on the TV. The Keatons had a big color Mitsubishi and watched some of the Sunday Super movie. Ava Gardner was in it, and Gregory Peck. Gregory seemed to be in love with Ava, although it was hard to tell. It might be the other woman he was in love with. There had been a nuclear war. Gregory Peck drove a submarine. None of this interested Nettie very much, so she turned off the TV, taped a pink slip to the screen, and went into the kitchen. She looked at what was in the cupboards. The dishes were Corel ware, very nice, but the pots and pans were nothing to write home about. Then checked the refrigerator. She wrinkled her nose. Too many leftovers. Too many leftovers was a sure sign of slipshod housekeeping. Not that Buster would know. She'd bet her boots on that. Men like Buster Keaton wouldn't be able to find their way around the kitchen with a map and a guide dog. She checked her watch again and started. She had spent an awfully long time wandering around the house. Too long. Quickly, she began to tear off slips of pink paper and tape them to things. The refrigerator, the stove, the telephone which hung on the kitchen wall by the garage doorway, the brake front in the dining room. And the more quickly she worked, the more nervous she became. Nettie had just gotten down to business when Keaton's red Cadillac crossed the tin bridge and started up Watermill Lane toward Castle View.
"Danforth," Myrtle asked suddenly, "could you let me out at Amanda Williams's house? I know it's a little out of the way, but she's got my fondue pot. I thought..."
The shy smile came and went on her face again.
"I thought I might make you, us, a little treat for the football game. You could just drop me off."
He opened his mouth to tell her the Williamses was a lot out of his way. The game was about to start, and she could get her goddamn fondue pot tomorrow. He didn't like cheese when it was hot and runny anyway. The goddamn stuff was probably full of bacteria. Then he thought better of it. Aside from himself, the board of selectmen was made up of two dumb bastards and one dumb bitch. Mandy Williams was the bitch. Keaton had been at some pains to see Bill Fullerton, the town barber, and Harry Samuels, Castle Rock's only mortician, on Friday. He was also at pains to make these seem like casual calls, but they weren't. There was always the possibility that the Board of Taxation had begun sending them letters as well. He had satisfied himself that they were not yet at least, but the Williams bitch had been out of town on Friday. "All right," he said, then added, "You might ask her if any town business has come to her attention. Anything I should get in touch with her about."
"Oh, honey, you know I can never keep that stuff straight."
"I do know that, but you can ask, can't you? You're not too dumb to ask, are you?"
"No," she said hastily in a small voice. He patted her hand.
"I'm sorry."
She looked at him with a wonderstruck expression. He had apologized to her.
Myrtle thought he might have done this at some time or other in their years of marriage, but she could not remember when. "Just ask her if the state boys have been bothering about anything lately," he said. "Land use regulations, the damn sewage, taxes maybe. I'd come in and ask myself, but I really want to catch the kickoff."
"All right, Dan."
The Williams house was halfway up Castle View. Keaton piloted the Cadillac into the driveway and parked behind the woman's car. It was foreign, of course. A Volvo. Keaton guessed the bitch was probably a closet communist, or lesbian, or both. Myrtle opened her door and got out, flashing him the shy, slightly nervous smile again as she did so.
I'll be home in half an hour.
Fine. Don't forget to ask if she's aware of any new town business, he said. And if Mert's description, garbled though it would surely be, of what Amanda Williams said raised even one single hackle on Keaton's neck, he would check in with the bitch personally, tomorrow. Not this afternoon. This afternoon was his. He was feeling much too good to even look at Amanda Williams, let alone make chit-chat with her. He hardly waited for Myrtle to close her door before throwing the Cadillac in reverse and backing down to the street again. Nettie had just taped the last of the pink sheets to the door of the closet in Keaton's study when she heard a car turn into the driveway. A muffled squeak escaped her throat. For a moment she was frozen in place, unable to move. A trickle of warm, stinging urine ran into her underwear.
Caught!
Her mind screamed as she listened to the soft, well-padded burble of the Cadillac's big engine.
Caught! Oh, Jesus, Savior, meek and mild, I'm caught! He'll kill me!
Mr. Gaunt's voice spoke in answer. It was not friendly now. It was cold, and it was commanding, and it came from a place deep in the center of her brain. He probably will kill you if he catches you, Nettie. And if you panic, he'll catch you for sure. The answer is simple. Don't panic. Leave the room. Do it now. Don't run, but walk fast and as quietly as you can. She hurried across the second-hand Turkish rug on the study floor, her legs as stiff as sticks, muttering, "Mr. Gaunt knows best," in a low litany, and entered the living room. Pink rectangles of paper glared at her from what seemed like every available surface. One even dangled from the central light fixture on a long strand of tape. Now the car's engine had taken on a hollow, echoey sound. Buster had driven into the garage. "Go, Nettie! Go right away! Now is your only chance!" She fled across the living room, tripped over a hassock, and went sprawling. She banged her head on the floor almost hard enough to knock herself out, would have knocked herself out almost certainly, but for the thin cushion of a throw rug. Bright globular lights skated across her field of vision. She scrambled up again, vaguely aware that her forehead was bleeding, and began fumbling at the knob of the front door as the car engine cut off in the garage. She cast a terrified glance back over her shoulder in the direction of the kitchen. She could see the door to the garage, the door he would come through. One of the pink slips of paper was taped to it. The doorknob turned under her hand, but the door wouldn't open. It seemed stuck shut. From the garage came a hefty swoop chunk as Keaton slammed his car door, then the rattle of the motorized garage door starting down on its tracks. She heard his footsteps gritting across the concrete. Buster was whistling. Nettie's frantic gaze, partially obscured by blood from her cut forehead, fell upon the thumb bolt. It had been turned. That was why the door wouldn't open for her. She must have turned it herself when she came in, although she couldn't remember doing it. She flicked it up, pulled the door open, and stepped through. Less than a second later, the door between the garage and the kitchen opened. Danforth Keaton stepped inside, unbuttoning his overcoat. He stopped. The whistle died on his lips. He stood there with his hands frozen in the act of undoing one of the lower coat buttons, his lips still pursed, and looked around the kitchen. His eyes began to widen. If he had gone to the living room window right then, he would have seen Nettie running wildly across his lawn, her unbuttoned coat billowing around her like the wings of a bat. He might not have recognized her, but he would surely have seen it was a woman, and this might have changed later events considerably. The sight of all those pink slips froze him in place, however, and in his shock, his mind was capable of producing two words and two words only. They flashed on and off inside his head like a giant neon sign with letters of screaming scarlet. The persecutors! The persecutors! The persecutors! Nettie reached the sidewalk and ran down Castle View as fast as she could. The heels of her loafers rattled a frightened tattoo, and her ears convinced her that she was hearing more feet than her own. Buster was behind her. Buster was chasing her, and when Buster caught her, he might hurt her. But that didn't matter. It didn't matter because he could do worse than just hurt her. Buster was an important man in town, and if he wanted her sent back to Juniper Hill, she would be sent. So Nettie ran. Blood trickled down her forehead and into her eye, and for a moment she saw the world through a pale red lens, as if all the nice houses on the view had begun to ooze blood. She wiped it away with the sleeve of her coat and went on running. The sidewalk was deserted, and most eyes inside the houses which were occupied this early Sunday afternoon were trained on the Patriots-Jets game. Nettie was seen by only one person. Tansy Williams, fresh from 2 days in Portland where she and her mommy had gone to visit Grandpa, was looking out of the living room window, sucking a lollipop and holding her teddy bear, Owen, under her left arm, when Nettie went by with wings on her heels. "Mommy, a lady just ran by," Tansy reported. Amanda Williams was sitting in the kitchen with Myrtle Keaton. They each had a cup of coffee. The fondue pot sat between them on the table. Myrtle had just asked if there was any town business going on that Dan should know about, and Amanda considered this a very odd question. If Buster wanted to know something, why hadn't he come in himself? For that matter, why such a question on a Sunday afternoon in the first place? "Honey, Mommy's talking with Mrs. Keaton." "She had blood on her," Tansy reported further. Amanda smiled at Myrtle. "I told Buddy that if he was going to rent that fatal attraction, he should wait until Tansy was in bed to watch it." Meantime, Nettie went on running. When she reached the intersection of Castle View and Laurel, she had to stop for a while. The public library was here, and there was a curved stone wall running around its lawn. She leaned against it, gasping and sobbing for breath as the wind tore past her, tugging at her coat. Her hands were pressed against her left side, where she had a deep stitch. She looked back up the hill and saw that the street was empty. Buster had not been following her after all. That had just been her imagination. After a few moments, she was able to hunt through her coat pockets for a Kleenex to wipe away some of the blood on her face. She found one, and she also discovered that the key to Buster's house was no longer there. It might have fallen out of her pocket as she ran down the hill, but she thought it more likely that she had left it in the lock of the front door. But what did that matter? She had gotten out before Buster saw her. That was the important thing. She thanked God that Mr. Gaunt's voice had spoken to her in the nick of time, forgetting that, if not for Mr. Gaunt, she would not have been in Buster's home at all. She looked at the smear of blood on the Kleenex and decided the cut probably wasn't as bad as it could have been. The flow seemed to be slowing down. The stitch in her side was going away, too. She pushed off the rock wall and began to plod toward home with her head down so the cut wouldn't show. Home, that was the thing to think about. Home in her beautiful carnival glass lampshade. Home in the Sunday Super movie. Home and Raider. When she was at home with the door locked, the shades pulled, the TV on, and Raider sleeping at her feet, all of this would seem like a horrible dream, the sort of dream she'd had in Juniper Hill after she had killed her husband. Home, that was the place for her. Nettie walked a little faster. She would be there soon. Pete and Wilma Jerzyk had a light lunch with the Pulaskis after Mass, and following lunch, Pete and Jake Pulaski settled in front of the TV to watch the Patriots kick some New York ass. Wilma cared not a fig for football, baseball, basketball, or hockey either, as far as that went. The only pro sport she liked was wrestling, and although Pete didn't know it, Wilma would have left him in the wink of an eye for Chief Jay Strongbow. She helped Frieda with the dishes, then said she was going home to watch the rest of the Sunday Super movie. It was On the Beach with Gregory Peck. She told Pete she was taking the car. "That's fine," he said, his eyes never leaving the TV. "I don't mind walking." "Goddamn good thing for you," she muttered under her breath as she went out. Wilma was actually in a good mood, and the major reason had to do with casino night. Father John wasn't backing down on it the way Wilma had expected him to do, and she had liked the way he'd looked that morning during the homily, which was called, "Let Us Each Tend Our Own Garden." His tone had been as mild as ever, but there had been nothing mild about his blue eyes or his out-thrust chin. Nor had all his fancy gardening metaphors fooled Wilma or anyone else about what he was saying. If the Baptists insisted on sticking their collective nose into the Catholic carrot patch, they were going to get their collective ass kicked.
The thought of kicking ass, particularly on this scale, always put Wilma in a good mood. Nor was the prospect of ass-kicking the only pleasure of Wilma's Sunday. She hadn't had to cook a heavy Sunday meal for once, and Pete was safely parked with Jake and Frida. If she was lucky, he would spend the whole afternoon watching men try to rupture each other's spleen, and she could watch the movie in peace. But first, she thought she might call on her old friend Nettie. She thought she had crazy Nettie pretty well buffaloed, and that was all very well, for a start. But only for a start. Nettie still had those muddy sheets to pay for, whether she knew it or not. The time had come to put a few more moves on Miss Mental Illness of 1991. This prospect filled Wilma with anticipation, and she drove home as fast as she could. Like a man in a dream, Danforth Keaton walked to his refrigerator and pulled off the pink slip which had been taped there. The words, "Traffic Violation Warning," were printed across the top in black block letters. Below these words was the following message. "Just a warning, but please read and heed. You have been observed breaking one or more traffic laws. The citing officer has elected to let you off with a warning this time, but he has recorded the make, model, and license number of your car, and the next time you will be charged. Please remember that traffic laws are for everybody. Drive defensively. Arrive alive. Your local police department thanks you." Below the sermon was a series of blanks labeled make, model, and license number. Printed on the slip in the first two blanks were the words Cadillac and Seville. Neatly printed in the blank for license number was this, Buster 1. Most of the slip was taken up by a checklist of common traffic violations such as failure to signal, failure to stop, and illegal parking. None of them was checked. Toward the bottom were the words other violations, followed by two blank lines. Other violations had been checked. The message on the lines provided to describe the violation was also neatly printed in small block capitals. It read, "Being the biggest cocksucker in Castle Rock." At the bottom was a line with the words "citing officer" printed under it. The rubber stamp signature on this line was Norris Ridgwick. Slowly, very slowly, Keaton clenched his fist on the pink slip. It crackled and bent and crumpled. At last it disappeared between Keaton's big knuckles. He stood in the middle of the kitchen, looking around at all the other pink slips. A vein beat time in the center of his forehead.
"I'll kill him," Keaton whispered. "I swear to God and all the saints, I'll kill that skinny little fuck."
When Nettie arrived home, it was only 1:20, but it felt to her as if she had been gone for months, maybe even years. As she walked up the cement path to her door, her terrors slipped from her shoulders like invisible weights. Her head still ached from the tumble she had taken, but she thought a headache was a very small price to pay for being allowed to arrive back at her own little house, safe and undetected. She still had her own key. That was in the pocket of her dress. She took it out and put it in the lock. "Rada," she called as she turned it. "Rada, I'm home." She opened the door. "Where's Mummy's widow boy, Where is ums? Is um hungry?" The hallway was dark, and at first she did not see the small bundle lying on the floor. She took a key out of the lock and stepped in. "Is Mummy's widow boy awful hungry? Is just so hung..." Her foot struck something which was both stiff and yielding, and her voice halted in mid-simper. She looked down and saw Rader. At first, she tried to tell herself she wasn't seeing what her eyes told her she was seeing. Wasn't. That wasn't Rader on the floor with something sticking out of his chest. How could it be? She closed the door and beat frantically at the wall switch with one hand. At last, the hall light jumped on and she saw. Rader was lying on the floor. He was lying on his back the way he did when he wanted to be scratched, and there was something red jutting out of him, something that looked like... Nettie uttered a high, wailing scream. It was so high it sounded like the whine of some huge mosquito, and fell on her knees beside her dog. "Rader!
Oh, Jesus, Savior, meek and mild. Oh, my God, Rita, you ain't dead, are you? You ain't dead.
Her hand, her cold, cold hand, beat at the red thing sticking out of Rader's chest the way it had beat at the light switch a few seconds before. At last it caught hold and she tore it free, using a strength drawn from the deepest wells of her grief and horror. The corkscrew came out with a thick ripping sound, pulling chunks of flesh, small clots of blood and tangles of hair with it. It left a ragged dark hole the size of a 410 slug. Nettie shrieked. She dropped the gory corkscrew and gathered the small, stiff body in her arms.
Rada! She cried. Oh, my little doggie! No! Oh, no!
She rocked him back and forth against her breast, trying to bring him back to life with her warmth, but it seemed she had no warmth to give. She was cold. Cold. Sometime later, she put his body down on the hall floor again and fumbled around with her hand until she found the Swiss Army knife with the murdering corkscrew jutting out of its handle. She picked it up dully, but some of that dullness left her when she saw that a note had been impaled upon the murder weapon. She pulled it off with numb fingers and held it up close in front of her. The paper was stiff with her poor little dog's blood, but she could still read the words scrawled on it. Nobody slings mud at my clean sheets. I told you I'd get you. The look of distracted grief and horror slowly left Nettie's eyes. It was replaced with a gruesome sort of intelligence that sparkled there like tarnished silver. Her cheeks, which had gone as pale as milk when she finally understood what had happened here, began to fill with dark red color. Her lips peeled slowly back from her teeth. She bared them at the note. Two harsh words slid out of her open mouth, hot and hoarse and rasping.
You bitch!
She crumpled the paper into her fist and threw it against the wall. It bounced back and landed near Rader's body. Nettie pounced upon it, picked it up, and spat on it. Then she threw it away again. She got up and walked slowly down to the kitchen, her hands opening, snapping shut into fists, then springing open, only to snap shut again. Wilma Jerzyk drove her little yellow Yugo into her driveway, got out, and walked briskly toward the front door, digging in her purse for her house key. She was humming Love Makes the World Go Round under her breath. She found the key, put it in the lock, and then paused as some random movement caught the corner of her eye. She looked to her right and gaped at what she saw. The living room curtains were fluttering in the brisk afternoon wind. They were fluttering outside the house. And the reason they were fluttering outside the house was that the big picture window, which had cost the Clooneys $400 to replace when their idiot son had broken it with a baseball 3 years ago, was shattered. Long arrows of glass pointed inward from the frame toward the central hole.
What the fuck?
Wilma cried and turned the key in the lock so hard she almost broke it off. She rushed indoors, grabbing the door to slam it shut behind her, and then froze in place. For the first time in her adult life, Wilma Wadlowski Jerzyk was shocked to complete immobility. The living room was a shambles. The TV, their beautiful big-screen TV on which they still owed 11 payments, was shattered. The innards were black and smoking. The picture tube lay in 1,000 shiny fragments on the carpet. Across the room, a huge hole had been knocked in one of the living room walls. A large package shaped like a loaf lay below this hole. Another lay in the doorway to the kitchen. She closed the door and approached the object in the doorway. One part of her mind, not quite coherent, told her to be very careful. It might be a bomb. As she passed the TV, she caught a hot, unpleasant aroma, a cross between singed insulation and burned bacon. She squatted down by the package in the doorway and saw it wasn't a package at all, at least not in the ordinary sense. It was a rock with a piece of lined notebook paper wrapped around it and held in place with a rubber band. She pulled the paper out and read this message. I told you to leave me alone. This is your last warning.
When she had read it twice, she looked at the other rock. She went over to it and pulled off the sheet of paper rubber-banded to it. Identical paper, identical message. She stood up, holding one wrinkled sheet in each hand, looking from one to the other again and again, her eyes moving like those of a woman watching a hotly contested ping-pong match. Finally, she spoke three words. Nettie. That cunt. She walked into the kitchen and drew in breath over her teeth in a harsh, whistling gasp. She cut her hand on a sliver of glass, taking the rock out of the microwave, and picked the splinter absently out of her palm before removing the paper banded to the rock. It bore the same message. Wilma walked quickly through the other rooms downstairs and observed more damage. She took all the notes. They were all the same. Then she walked back to the kitchen. She looked at the damage unbelievingly. Nettie, she said again. At last, the iceberg of shock around her was beginning to melt. The first emotion to replace it was not anger, but incredulity. My, she thought, that woman really must be crazy. She really must, if she thought she could do something like this to me, and live to see the sun go down. Who did she think she was dealing with here, Rebecca of Fuckybrook Farm? Wilma's hand closed on the notes in a spasm. She bent over and rubbed the crumpled carnation of paper sticking out of her fist briskly over her wide bottom. I wipe my fucking ass on your last warning, she cried and threw the papers away. She looked around the kitchen again with the wondering eyes of a child. A hole in the microwave, a big dent in the Amana refrigerator, broken glass all over. In the other room, the TV, which had cost them almost $1,600, smelled like a fryolator full of hot dog shit. And who had done it all? Who? Why, Nettie Cobb had done it. That was who. Miss Mental Illness of 1991. Wilma began to smile. A person who did not know Wilma might have mistaken it for a gentle smile, a kindly smile, a smile of love and good fellowship. Her eyes shone with some powerful emotion. The unwary might have mistaken it for exaltation. But if Peter Jerzyk, who knew her best, had seen her face at that moment, he would have run the other way as fast as his legs could carry him. No, Wilma said in a soft, almost caressing voice. Oh, no, babe. You don't understand. You don't understand what it means to fuck with Wilma. You don't have the slightest idea of what it means to fuck with Wilma Wadlowski Jerzyk. Her smile widened. But you will. Two magnetized steel strips had been mounted on the wall near the microwave. Most of the knives which had hung from these strips had been knocked loose by the rock Brian had pegged into the radar range. They lay on the counter in a pickup sticks jumble. Wilma picked out the longest, a Kingsford carving knife with a white bone handle, and slowly ran her wounded palm along the side of the blade, smearing the cutting edge with blood. I'm going to teach you everything you need to know. Holding the knife in her fist, Wilma strode across the living room, crunching glass from the broken window in the TV picture tube under the low heels of her black for-church shoes. She went out the door without closing it and cut across her lawn in the direction of Ford Street. At the same time Wilma was selecting a knife from the clutter of them on the counter, Nettie Cobb was pulling a meat cleaver from one of her kitchen drawers. She knew it was sharp because Bill Fullerton, down at the barber shop, had put an edge on it for her less than a month ago. Nettie turned and walked slowly down the hallway toward her front door. She stopped and knelt for a moment beside Raider, her poor little dog who had never done anything to anyone. I wonder, she said softly as she stroked Raider's fur. I wonder. I gave that crazy Polish woman every chance. I gave her every chance in the world. My dear little doggie, you wait for me. You wait, because I'll be with you soon. She got up and went out of her house, bothering with the door no more than Wilma had bothered with hers. Security had ceased to interest Nettie. She stood on the stoop for a moment, taking deep breaths, then cut across her lawn in the direction of Willow Street. Danforth Keaton ran into his study and ripped open the closet door. He crawled all the way to the back,
For a terrible moment, he thought the game was gone, that the goddamn intruding, persecuting motherfucker deputy sheriff had taken it, and his future along with it. Then his hands fell upon the box, and he tore back the lid. The tin racetrack was still there, and the envelope was still tucked beneath it. He bent it back and forth, listening to the bills crackle inside, and then replaced it. He hurried to the window, looking out for Myrtle. She mustn't see the pink slips. He had to take them all down before Myrtle got back, and how many were there? 100? He looked around his study and saw them stuck up everywhere. 1,000? Yes, maybe. Maybe 1,000. Even 2,000 did not seem entirely out of the question. He ran through the living room, the top of his head brushed the slip hanging from the light fixture, making it swing back and forth, and turned the thumb lock on the door. Then he remembered that she would have her key, and he put on the bolt, and the chain, too, just for good measure. If she got here before he was done cleaning up, she would just have to wait on the step, because he wasn't going to let her in until every one of those goddamn persecuting things was burning in the kitchen wood stove. Every damned one. He snatched the slip dangling from the light fixture. The tape stuck to his cheek, and he pawed it away with a little squeal of anger. On this one, a single word glared up from the line reserved for other violations. Embezzlement. He ran to the reading lamp by his easy chair, snatched up the slip taped to the shade. Other violations. Misappropriation of town funds. The TV. Horse fucking. The glass of his Lions Club Good Citizenship Award mounted above the fireplace. Cornholing your mother. The kitchen door. Compulsive money chucking at Lewiston Raceway. The door to the garage. Psychotic garbage head paranoia. He gathered them up as fast as he could, eyes wide and bulging from his fleshy face, his thinning hair standing up in wild disarray. He was soon panting and coughing, and an ugly reddish-purple color began to overspread his cheeks. He looked like a fat child with a grown-up's face on some strange, desperately important treasure hunt. He pulled one from the front of the china closet, stealing from the town pension fund to play the ponies. Keaton hurried into his study with a pile of slips clutched in his right hand, strands of tape flying back from his fist, and began to pluck up more of the slips. The ones in here all stuck to a single subject and with horrible accuracy. Embezzlement. Theft. Stealing. Embezzlement. Fraud. Misappropriation. Bad stewardship. Embezzlement. That word most of all, glaring, shouting, accusing. Other violations, embezzlement. He thought he heard something outside and ran to the window again. Maybe it was Myrtle. Maybe it was Norris Ridgwick come by to gloat and laugh. If so, Keaton would get his gun and shoot him, but not in the head. No, in the head would be too good, too quick for scum like Ridgwick. Keaton would gut-hole him and leave him to scream himself to death on the lawn. But it was only the Garson scout trundling down the view toward town. Scott Garson was the town's most important banker. Keaton and his wife sometimes took dinner with the Garsons. They were nice people, and Garson himself was politically important. What would he think if he saw these slips? What would he think of that word, embezzlement, screaming off the pink violation slips again and again, screaming like a woman being raped in the middle of the night? He ran back into the dining room, panting. Had he missed any? He didn't think so. He'd gotten them all, at least down here. No, there was one, right on the newel post of the stairway. What if he had missed that one? My God! He ran to it, snatched it up. Make, shitmobile. Model, old and weary. License number, old fuck one. Other violations, financial faggotry. More? Were there more? Keaton coursed through the downstairs room at a dead run. His shirt tail had come out of his pants, and his hairy belly was bobbling wildly over his belt buckle. He saw no more, at least, not down here. After another quick, frantic look out the window to make sure Mert wasn't in sight yet, he pelted upstairs with his heart thundering in his chest. Wilma and Nettie met on the corner of Willow and Ford. There they halted, staring at each other like gunslingers in a spaghetti western. The wind flapped their coats briskly to and fro. The sun shuddered in and out of the clouds. Their shadows came and went like fitful visitors. No traffic moved on either of these two streets, or on the sidewalks.
They owned this little corner of the autumn afternoon.
You kill my dog, you bitch!
You broke my TV. You broke my windows. You broke my microwave, you crazy cunt!
I warn you!
Stick your warning up your old dirt road.
I'm going to kill you.
Take one step and someone's going to die here, all right, but it won't be me.
Wilma spoke these words with alarm and dawning surprise. Nettie's face made her realize for the first time that the two of them might be about to engage in something a little more serious than pulling hair or ripping clothes. What was Nettie doing here in the first place? What had happened to the element of surprise? How had things come so quickly to the sticking point? But there was a deep streak of Polish Cossack in Wilma's nature, a part that found such questions irrelevant. There was a battle to be fought here. That was the important thing. Nettie ran at her, lifting the cleaver as she came. Her lips peeled back from her teeth, and a long howl tore out of her throat. Wilma crouched, holding her knife like a giant switchblade. As Nettie closed with her, Wilma drove it forward. It thrust deep into Nettie's bowels and then rose, slitting her stomach open and letting out a spurt of stinking gruel. Wilma felt a moment's horror at what she had done. Could it really be Wilma Jerzyk on the other end of the steel buried in Nettie? And her arm muscles relaxed. The knife's upward momentum died before the blade could reach Nettie's frantically pumping heart.
Ooh, you bitch!
Nettie screamed and brought the cleaver down. It buried itself to the hilt in Wilma's shoulder, splitting the collarbone with a dull crunch. The pain, a huge wooden plank of it, drove any objective thought from Wilma's mind. Only the raving Cossack was left. She yanked her knife free. Nettie yanked her cleaver free. It took both hands to do it, and when she finally succeeded in wrenching it off the bone, a loose slew of guts slipped from the bloody hole in her dress and hung before her in a glistening knot. The two women circled slowly, their feet printing tracks in their own blood. The sidewalk began to look like some weird Arthur Murray dance diagram. Nettie felt the world beginning to pulse in and out in great slow cycles. The color would drain from things, leaving her in a blur of whiteness, and then it would slowly come back. She heard her heart in her ears, great, slow, snaffling thuds. She knew she was wounded but felt no pain. She thought Wilma might have cut her a little in the side or something. Wilma knew how badly she was hurt, was aware she could no longer lift her right arm, and that the back of her dress was drenched with blood. She had no intention of even trying to run away, however. She had never run in her life, and she wasn't going to start now.
Hi!
Someone screamed thinly at them from across the street.
Hi! What are you two ladies doing there? You stop it, whatever it is. You stop it right now, or I'll call the police.
Wilma turned her head in that direction. The moment her attention was diverted, Nettie stepped in and swung the cleaver in a flat, sweeping arc. It chopped into the swell of Wilma's hip and clanged off her pelvic bone, cracking it. Blood flew in a fan. Wilma screamed and flailed backward, sweeping the air in front of her with her knife. Her feet tangled together, and she fell to the sidewalk with a thump.
Hi! Hi!
It was an old woman, standing on her stoop and clutching a mouse-colored shawl to her throat. Her eyes were magnified into watery wheels of terror by her spectacles. Now she trumpeted in her clear and piercing old lady voice,
"Help! Police! Murder! Murder!"
The women on the corner of Willow and Ford took no notice. Wilma had fallen in a bloody heap by the stop sign, and as Nettie staggered toward her, she pushed herself into a sitting position against its post and held the knife in her lap, pointing upward.
"Come on, you bitch!" she snarled. "Come for me if you're coming!"
Nettie came, her mouth working. The ball of her intestines swung back and forth against her dress like a misborn fetus. Her right foot struck Wilma's outstretched left foot, and she fell forward. The carving knife impaled her just below the breastbone. She grunted through a mouthful of blood, raised the cleaver, and brought it down. It buried itself in the top of Wilma Jerzyk's head with a single dull sound. Chonk! Wilma began to convulse, her body bucking and sunfishing under Nettie's. Each buck and thrash drove the carving knife in deeper.
"Killed my doggy!"
Nettie gasped, spitting a fine mist of blood into Wilma's upturned face with every word.
Then she shuddered all over and went limp. Her head bonked the post of the stop sign as it fell forward. Wilma's jittering foot slid into the gutter. Her good black for church shoe flew off and landed in a pile of leaves with its low heel pointing up at the bustling clouds. Her toes flexed once, once more, and then relaxed. The two women lay draped over each other like lovers, their blood painting the cinnamon-colored leaves in the gutter.
Murder!
The old woman across the street trumpeted again, and then she rocked backward and fell full length on her own hall floor in a faint. Others in the neighborhood were coming to windows and opening doors now, asking each other what had happened, stepping out on stoops and lawns, first approaching the scene cautiously, then backing away in a hurry, hands over mouths, when they saw not only what had happened, but the gory extent of it. Eventually, someone called the sheriff's office. Polly Chalmers was walking slowly up Main Street toward Needful Things with her aching hands bundled into her warmest pair of mittens when she heard the first police siren. She stopped and watched as one of the county's three brown Plymouth cruisers belted through the intersection of Main and Laurel, lights flashing and twirling. It was doing 50 already and still accelerating. It was closely followed by a second cruiser. She watched them out of sight, frowning. Sirens and racing police cruisers were a rarity in the Rock. She wondered what had happened. Something a little more serious than a cat up a tree, she supposed. Alan would tell her when he called that evening. Polly looked up the street again and saw Leland Gaunt standing in the doorway of his shop, also watching after the cruisers with an expression of mild curiosity on his face. Well, that answered one question. He was in. Nettie had never called her back to let her know one way or another. This hadn't surprised Polly much. The surface of Nettie's mind was slippery, and things had a way of sliding right off. She walked on up the street. Mr. Gaunt looked around and saw her. His face lit up in a smile. "Miss Chalmers, how nice that you could drop by." She smiled wanly. The pain, which had abated for a while that morning, was now creeping back, thrusting its network of thin, cruel wires through the flesh of her hands. "I thought we'd agreed on Polly." "Polly, then. Come inside. It's awfully good to see you. What's all the excitement?" "I don't know," she said. He held the door for her, and she went past him into the shop. "I suppose someone's been hurt and needs to go to the hospital. Medical assistance in Norway is awfully slow on the weekends, although why the dispatcher would send two cruisers..." Mr. Gaunt closed the door behind them. The bell tinkled. The shade on the door was down, and with the sun now going the other way, the interior of Needful Things was gloomy. But, Polly thought, if gloom could ever be pleasant, this gloom was. A small reading lamp shed a golden circle on the counter by Mr. Gaunt's old-fashioned cash register. A book lay open there. It was Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Mr. Gaunt was looking at her closely, and Polly had to smile again at the expression of concern in his eyes. "My hands have been kicking up the very dickens these last few days," she said. "I guess I don't exactly look like Demi Moore." "You look like a woman who is very tired and in quite a lot of discomfort," he said. The smile on her face wavered. There was understanding and deep compassion in his voice, and for a moment Polly was afraid she might burst into tears. The thought which kept the tears at bay was an odd one. "His hands. If I cry, he'll try to comfort me. He'll put his hands on me." She buttressed the smile. "I'll survive. I always have. Tell me, did Nettie Cobb happen to drop by?"
"Today?"
He frowned. "No, not today. If she had, I would have shown her a new piece of carnival glass that came in yesterday. It's not as nice as the one I sold her last week, but I thought she might be interested.